Hello, beautiful people. My guest today is Nathan Barry, and Nathan is someone who's been a creator for the past decade. He started off by writing, by designing, and documenting his journey, and since then, he's built up ConvertKit, which is now a company that does over $2 million a month in monthly recurring revenue, which is just absurd. ConvertKit has worked with creators like Gretchen Rubin, Chris Gullibo, Pat Flynn, Tim Ferriss, and Tim McGraw. So this was a wide-ranging conversation about creation, about some of Nathan's earliest business ventures, and I had a great time learning about his story and how he's navigated the past decade online as a creator. I hope you guys enjoy my conversation. And if you do, or if you have any thoughts about the episode, let me know on Twitter, at HeyDannyMiranda. I love your feedback about these episodes. They make my day, and I'm so grateful whenever I get a message from one of you. Let's get right into the episode with Nathan Barry.
Interesting people, thought-provoking conversations, nutrition for your brain. Journey through the minds of the world's top performers and discover what it really takes to achieve your highest version. This is the Danny Miranda Podcast.
So I figured we'd start off with receiving a $75 payment for designing a logo for the Idaho Chess Association. How did that happen?
That's a good question. So, let's see. Early days of high school, I started to get into building websites. I was actually dating a girl in high school who was building websites on GeoCities, which, you know, was the way that you built websites back then. And, you know, she was looking up code, pasting it in, little like animated GIFs and stuff like that, just really messing around and having a playground on the web. And I thought that was super interesting. And so I was like, wait, how do you write code? What is this? You know? And so she showed me a little bit, and then I ended up taking it quite a bit further and going like, okay, let me get books from the library on HTML and CSS. This is probably 2004, I think. And so I just started diving in. I quickly realized that it wasn't just the code that you wrote, especially back then. You needed design abilities. And so I wanted Photoshop. Photoshop was like $800. And so that wasn't going to be a thing that would happen. But I convinced my parents to buy me Photoshop Elements for my birthday. I think it was like $60 or $70 on sale. And so with that, I started messing around with designing logos and like really basic things. Back then, if you wanted to do rounded corners on a website, you had to like make images and slice them out. You know, if you want to do drop shadows, any of that stuff, you had to, you know, now you just type like border radius, you know, 5 pixels and that's it. But it was, you know, a lot harder then. And so it was really that combination of, you know, HTML, CSS, hand coded in Notepad, and then Photoshop Elements. And I played around with that a lot. For the chess association specifically, my brothers were really into chess. And so they would play in tournaments and stuff like that. And that's how we met how I met those people there and designed a logo. Logo was $75 that I charged. So big money. And then the website, which was the first web design gig that I got paid for, was $300. So that was first money made freelancing, those two things.
Wow. And then you were on your way to paying off the Photoshop Elements payment, right?
Yeah. I didn't, you know, that was a gift from my parents, so I didn't have to pay that one back, but, you know, you could dive into the next thing from there.
Yeah. Well, so one of the things that I found out about you when doing research for this conversation is that your mom forced you to start writing when you were 12 or 13 and how much of a critical role that played. Why? So you're building these design skills, and then you're also building these writing skills. Why was writing such an important facet from your mom's perspective
to start? Yeah, well, so my mom homeschooled my siblings and I. She has a degree in English and literature, and you know, she just always thought that, you know, reading literature and especially writing are just really important to education. It's kind of interesting now, like you have a lot of great business thinkers, you know, bloggers, people writing like, take like Jason Fried. Jason talks about clear writing being one of the most important business skills that you can have. And so he and my mom would get along really well because she was saying like, you know, being an effective writer is so important. And I would always tell her like, why am I spending this time writing these essays, book reports, you know, any of these things? I'm never going to be a writer. Like I'm going to be a landscaper. I'm going to be, you know, later on, I'm going to be a web designer. Like I want to be anything except a writer. And she just said like, well, writing is important for a lot of jobs and like, you know, do your school. And I ended up being really, really grateful for that because she was absolutely right. Writing is critical. And now even when hiring for people to join ConvertKit, our software company, we look for people who are clear writers. Because as Jason Fried talks about, if you're a clear writer, you're probably a clear thinker. And, you know, that's what we need. And so much communication is written now. And then also writing is the single biggest skill and asset you can have for building an audience, which is one of the most remarkable ways to earn a living. So my mom in, you know, 2000 to 2002 or so when she was forcing me to write, she was spot on.
At what point did you realize, oh, shoot, mom's right?
It probably wasn't until I was 18 or 19, maybe even... Like that's the point where I got into blogs to the point where I was thinking, oh, maybe I would start a blog. And so it might've even been later than that, but a lot of early bloggers that I followed, people like Chris Guillebeau, Tim Ferriss, Marie Forleo, I'm trying to think who else would be in that list. Again, Brett McKay, who wrote The Art of Manliness, you know, a bunch of blogs from that time period. I was watching them earn quite a bit of money. Like a blog went from this thing that you kind of did on the side and hey, maybe it makes some money in AdSense dollars or whatever, to like watching Chris Guillebeau in particular. He published this ebook. He always has the best names for his ebooks. One of them is titled A Brief Guide to World Domination. That was the first one that he put out. And then the second one was 279 Days to Overnight Success. And I've just always loved that title because it sums up the overnight success side so well. But in that, he detailed basically his path from starting a blog to it being able to pay for his world travels. And for him, that was $60,000 a year, so $5,000 a month. And he was making that money mostly from ebooks, guides. Like it was all from writing. And so that's when the pieces started to come together. I'm like, oh, okay, design, code, those are important skills, but writing is just as important as far as, you know, making money and earning a living. So then over the next couple of years, I like dipped my toes into starting a blog more and building an audience. And it took time, but yeah, that it was really seeing like Chris Guillebeau talk about his business and how core writing was to it that I realized like, oh, thanks, Mom.
When did you start getting turned on to all these people? Because from doing research, it sounds like you were someone who always wanted to be older and was foraying older. And I relate to that so much. I was 13 years old and starting blogs, just like, you know, some of these blogs you mentioned. And I was like, always playing in that field. But it sounds like you were also that way. And so how did that come to be?
Yeah, well, I was definitely always trying, like a lot of my friends were older. I tried to graduate from high school, or I did graduate from high school early, and just really tried to, basically as far as the pushing to be older, like that side of it, really started, or I put in a concerted effort once I was probably 13, I think, and realized that a bunch of my friends were like 15, 16, and maybe even somewhere 17. And so I didn't feel like there was that big of a gap between us until I realized that they're all going to go off to college and I'm not. Like, you know, oh, we're all in high school together or we can run in the same circles. But then like college was going to make this really obvious that, you know, they're several years older and we're going to have this big rift in our group and I'm going to be left behind. And so that's when I went to my parents and said, hey, this high school thing. Is it 4 years or is it a set amount of work and curriculum? And I have older siblings, and so, you know, who had been homeschooled through high school already. And so my mom kind of looked at it and was like, well, it's a, like, it's that curriculum. We've already established it and all of that. So I guess you can do it sooner. I was like, great. Like, give it to me in to-do list form and we'll knock it out. And so I remember I live in Boise, Idaho, and that's where I grew up. And then my parents are originally from Western Washington. And so we make that drive from Boise to Seattle, which is like 8 hours or so, once or twice a year for family vacation and see family. And I remember thinking, okay, I'm bored when I'm doing algebra. I'm also bored on these road trips. So like, why not combine those two things and, you know, just get it out of the way. And so in 8 hours of driving, I'm like, my older brother, who's 6 years older than me, would be sitting next to me, and, you know, he knows all this algebra stuff. And so when I get stuck, I'd ask him a question. You can get through like a month's worth of math lessons, you know, on a road trip. And that was pre-iPad, you know, pre-laptop. And so it was like, great, you know, you get that done. And so that really got me ahead on school. I guess the other side of your question was, where did the blogs come from? And I was just fascinated by business. I read early books that I picked up in that world would be like Rich Dad, Poor Dad, or Michael Gerber's The E-Myth. I was just always interested in trying to learn how to make money. But the blogs came from, I guess, two sides. One was in the web design world. If you want to learn anything, you're learning it on a blog. Like the books that I got from the library were, you know, that was how I got started. But then the web standards movement was really big then, of moving in coding from tables and inline CSS over to, you know, standards-based code. So that was all taking place on blogs. So I was reading more of those. And then at the same time, someone gave me a copy of Tim Ferriss's The 4-Hour Workweek. And so in 2008, that was like, oh, whoa. And then I was reading Tim's blog, and Chris Guillebeau had written a guest post. And then, so like, I read that, and then Chris was on his book tour and he was coming to Boise. And so then that like really expanded the whole world of getting me deeply embedded in all things blogs, podcasts, you know, and writing online.
On the piece of the older friends, why do you think you had so many older friends?
It's a good question. Maybe the simplest answer is I have older siblings, and so I was trying to keep up with them, you know? And so a lot of my friends were their friends, you know? And so that probably naturally, like, someone could do, I imagine, a whole study on, and it's probably been done, on birth order and, you know, various things there. And so I was always trying to keep up with my older siblings. And so I think that just made me naturally like, try to be older, grow up faster. I also, my family didn't have much money. And so that was always a point of contention in the family, and then just a point of stress for me, or for everyone. But, and so I was always trying to find ways to make money and, you know, learn about businesses or do woodworking or whatever else. And so I was the kid who was trying to grow up absolutely as fast as possible.
Mm. And you graduated high school at 15, is that correct?
Yeah, at 15.
And then take me through what your next moves are in life.
Yeah. So, you know, the trying to do school as fast as possible paid off. It took me basically 2 years to like get through all of the high school curriculum and start going to college. I was able to do like the final math classes instead of doing them in high school. I was able to take college classes, which was great. One fun little thing, another friend who was a couple years older than me, she had also gone, she had started going to college when she was 16, you know, I think first taking a couple classes and then like finished high school maybe at 16 and a half or 17, and then started going full time. And she'd given me a tip that basically, don't tell anyone how old you are because they'll treat you differently. And I was like, well, how are you not going to tell people how old you are? And she said, oh, it's easy. They'll ask like, how old are you? You know, and sort of that questioning, and you're like, oh, guess. And they'll be like, I mean, you know, like running through that. I mean, he looks 15, but there's no way that he's here and he's 15. So like 17? And you're like, yeah. Oh, you say, oh, good guess. And like, then they're like, okay, you're confirming that I guessed correctly. And you're like, maybe, but you just move on. Like it was legitimately a good guess. And so it's wrong, but I'm not going to tell you that it's wrong or not. So I remember doing that because I think there were one or two times before I took that advice to heart that I had told people how old I was. And, you know, you get a bunch of 18-year-old college freshmen and they do treat you differently when they're like, okay, he's not just looking super young. He is super young. So withholding some information can be strategic at times.
It reminds me. It reminds me of the standard pace is for chumps from Derek Sivers. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I'm very familiar with it. I have how many copies of Anything You Want? I only have two copies of Anything You Want on my shelf right now. But it's my favorite book to give away. Yeah, and it's exactly that. My version of that early on, and this is one of the amazing things about homeschooling, was talking. I remember a day when I was probably 11 or 12 and we lived up in the mountains outside of Boise. And so it's just, it starts to snow and it's just the most like the perfect giant flakes. You can basically watch the level of snow growing, you know? And so you're just staring out the window and there's this amazing snow accumulating. It's like, ah, oh, this is perfect sledding. Like how long do I have to sit in here and do school? And, you know, to my parents' credit, again, they're just like, it's how long you do school is up to you. We don't do it for 5 hours a day or, you know, whatever, you know, from 8 to 3. It's just, here's the list as soon as you get it done. And my mom said that of like, oh, okay, I can be dialed in and focused. Like, let's get all of this done. And, you know, an hour or two later, I'm out there sledding because I was really motivated. And so that was like the first version of realizing, okay, you can set your own pace, you know, or like Derek Sivers' music teacher, you know, said of like the standard pace is for chumps. And then that played forward into more things of like, okay, I can do things on my own. I can go through high school at my own pace. And then when I went to college, it was also kind of that thing of not following the regular playbook. I did 2 years of school, first graphic design. And then I didn't like how far it went into art. I wanted to do like computer graphics and web and stuff like that. And it was like deep into all things art. And that wasn't what I wanted. And so I switched to a marketing degree. And then ultimately I dropped out. So I dropped out of college at 17 after 2 years, which is, you know, before most people drop out of high school. And the reason that I dropped out is I was getting more and more web design clients. And, you know, I was going to school in order to learn how to make money. That was my goal. People told me, if you get a degree, you're earning potential, you know, like you show me all the charts and everything. I'm like, okay, all right, I'll get the degree. That sounds good. You know, I want to earn more money. And my freelancing had changed from the $75 logos and the $300 websites to, at that point, I landed my first $10,000 web design, like web application project, and a big build. And I remember calling my mom and being like, I think I want to drop out, you know? And she was, again, really supportive of that. Because it was like, look, I'm making the money that I set out to make. And so it's just time to pursue that directly rather than continue with school.
What made your parents so forward thinking in the sense of, you know, they're giving you this time frame of just complete your work, which is a very internet way of thinking. It's about the time that it's not about a set time. It's about just completing it. And then supportive of dropping out. Why do you think your parents were that way?
Yeah, that's a good question. They've always been that way. My parents are very avid learners. So whether it's things like my dad owned a Christian bookstore for a long time and would always be reading. You know, he's the person who would like both my parents like in reading the Bible for them, they're like, oh, I think if I learned some ancient Greek, that would help me understand this better. You know, they're like that kind of person who would just be like, oh, let's just dive in and learn it. My mom, you know, has all kinds of certifications. Like she, in addition to homeschooling all of us, she would write homeschooling curriculum because she felt like it. She created a language flashcards method well before, like, you know, iPhone apps made delayed repetition. Like she made a folder and a system to do all of that. That, you know, tools like, what is it, Anki and others, you know, are now popular on iPhone. She was doing that in like 1993. Let's see, what other things? Just constantly, my dad built the house that we grew up in. They were not fans of like putting kids through factory education of like, you know, buy, like join your grade, only hang out with kids your age, you know, sit in a classroom for this amount of time. It was all about hands-on learning, customized to each kid. The other thing that they really stressed that I think was really important is I think a lot of people, when a kid goes to school, if you think about whose responsibility is it that that kid gets a good education or that learns the material. And, you know, a lot of people be like the teacher needs to make like, needs to do it in this way. Or in homeschooling would say like the parent, it's their responsibility. And maybe it's just because there are so many of us kids, because I have five siblings, that there couldn't be that level of individual attention. It was very much our job as the kid. Like you are in charge of your education. If you don't learn, that is your fault. Like here's what you're supposed to learn. Now learn it. And if you need help, come ask me as the parent. But like, I'm not going to sit here and teach everything to you. So I think that was a really important thing because it teaches, like you're talking about, these very internet age type things of like, all the information is there. There's no speed limit. Like it's entirely up to you as the individual. And so that served me really well when it came time to learn web design. I wasn't like sitting down and like, all right, who's going to teach me web design? You know, come teach me, you know, and if I don't learn this, it's your fault. Instead, it was like, there's infinite information out there on the internet. It's a Google search away. The only limiting factor is your desire to put in the time and effort to learn it and practice and then seek out help.
How could we better instill that in the American public school system?
Oh, I have no idea. I've never been to public school. I'm a little bit of the person who would refer to public schools as government schools, you know, and say like, throw the whole system out. It's broken.
Okay. So how do we fix the system in your perspective?
Yeah. I think there's a lot of interesting things with charter schools. You know, probably the first thing I would do is make more funding available to some of these non-traditional schools, where they're doing something like emphasizing, arts, you know, learning foreign languages, things like that, the Montessori schools, any of these things, I think that are where you're ending up in much smaller, smaller classrooms customized to the kids. And also just this idea that, hey, one school might be a good fit for one kid and it might not be a good fit for another kid. And so having that choice, other things that I love would be like really hands-on projects. Like a friend who went to a public school was able to get his EMT certification in high school. Or like people going, you know, machine shop or like working small engines, any of these things that let people do really hands-on, whether it's trades or anything else, I'm a big fan of, and especially if it lets people follow their interest, right? So obviously you're not going to have everyone who's going through high school be like, okay, and now you become an EMT, you know, but I think it's great when some of these schools have those programs. So if someone has the interest, they can learn those things. And also I would try to avoid, I guess putting it in a positive thing, I would try to mix age groups more often. I think that, a lot of kids will fall into the exact same habits and patterns of behavior if they're with people who are precisely their own age. And so if you can do that, put kids, like kids who are a little bit older, give them responsibilities to help and teach some of the younger kids, give some of the younger kids the opportunities to hang out with and learn from some of the older kids and like be called to a little bit of a high, like more mature, more capable level. And then probably the last thing is I would just emphasize tons of free play. There's a lot of studies on that. It's really interesting of like, go back to the days of the kids just roam the neighborhood and, you know, like we started to get into this territory of, you know, there's a kid out. I actually remember that. I remember being at a Kmart, I was probably like 12 or 13. And so many times being homeschooled, we would always do things when, like, if you're going to go to the lake, Wednesday afternoon is the perfect time to go to the lake because there's nobody else there, you know, all of that. And I remember later, like, people wanting to go skiing, and I'm like, but it's Saturday. Why would you want to go skiing on Saturday? There's going to be lines. What's wrong with you? But one thing that would happen is we'd be out and about, and people would be like, shouldn't you be in school? You know? And I just think the more you can encourage free play, like, let the kids, there was a story years ago about someone who lives in New York City and their kid loved the subway. And so they let their 9-year-old, I think, ride the subway by himself. And like, that was a super controversial thing. And I'm like, great. Teach the kid how to navigate all the scenarios and then give him that responsibility and, you know, have some safety nets. I mean, now just give him a phone where he can call you if anything goes wrong. But like, the world is in every way so much safer than it was, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. And like, all the statistics are showing it. So like, give kids more freedom, less structured class time, more opportunities to pursue things they're interested in. So yeah, apparently I do have thoughts on the subject.
You just gave the example of give the kid the phone. I'm curious what age you think kids should get phones or iPhones.
Yeah. So I mean, give the kid the phone in the way of like, if something goes wrong, they can like call mom, you know, or call dad. Like, I'm hopeful there's a few things out there of like the really basic, like now it's kind of hard to get a basic flip phone or something like that, you know, but you can still do it. I think that kind of thing is great. I have a 9-year-old who he turns 10 this year. And so I'm going to have to figure out the devices thing. My kids aren't at the age yet where they're like asking to start YouTube channels but it'll come soon. So I don't know. We have like my 9-year-old, doesn't have a phone. I don't know when he'll get it. Probably when he pays for it himself. That'll be the thing. Maybe 14, 15, who knows? They do have, like, we do have a family iPad that, you know, the kids use quite a bit. So I'm not a hard line, no screens kind of person.
It's so interesting because, like, in one sense, they could gain a competitive advantage of learning a skill in some capacity by getting at an earlier age. In another sense, it could be programming their dopamine in a way that's harmful.
Yes.
Right? So what do you think?
Yeah, on that note, like the competitive advantage thing is interesting. I was obviously a kid trying to do everything as early as possible. And it has stacked up to the fact that, like, you know, I'm 30 and run a 60 person company and a bunch of stuff because I like compressed this, life, I guess. I wouldn't advocate that everyone try to grow up really quickly. I also think that, you know, you get it where people are trying to get their kids to learn something as quick as possible. Like, little Johnny's only 7 and he can already, you know, do trigonometry or whatever. And it's like, especially in the early days, I just feel like if the kid is a little bit older, they'll have so much easier of a time learning it that you might put in all of this effort to get them this far ahead. Whereas later, it would just have taken this far much effort to learn the same thing. So the approach that we've taken is not trying to like rush them or like push them grades ahead or anything like that. It's been to encourage a ton of reading. That was another thing in our household. Like, growing up in the mountains, like 45 minutes outside of town. And we weren't big on TV or anything like that. So like the library was really important. And like, we'd come out of the library with like a big stack of books. I'm like, Mom, I don't know if this is enough to last like, you know, a full week till we come back to the library. And she's like, you'll be fine. You'll borrow a book from your, like your sibling's biggest stack, you know? So just emphasizing reading a ton, is probably what I would do. And then, yeah, I don't have this desire of like, oh, let me teach them to code by the time that they're seven, so that, or whatever else. Though when they show an interest, like my kids have shown an interest in, like writing basic HTML, and like, my son wanted to make a website for his soccer club. And so it's like, okay, like I'll show you how to do that. And so we'll encourage more of that as it comes up, but not push it too much.
What were some of the books that were laying around your house when you were a kid?
Well, a lot of literature. I'm trying to think, you know, everything from, like the Little House on the Prairie books, which those are funny because in some circles, everyone's like, oh yeah, obviously we read those so much. And in other circles, people are like, what are those even? I'm curious, do you know those books?
No.
Okay. So basically, the author, her name's Laura Ingalls Wilder, and it's about her life, growing up. I think they were in New York State originally in like the mid 1800s. And then gradually they moved and worked their way west. And so it's like Little House in the Big Woods, Little House on the Prairie, you know, like all of that. And so it's just a story written from, you know, first like an 8-year-old's perspective. And then as she grows up, of like her family self-reliance, and they're just great stories. So a lot of probably that kind of thing of, you know, American literature, I don't know, Catcher in the Rye, like a bunch of that kind of stuff. And then just whatever other things we're interested in. I remember like my parents just had a ton of books. And so we'd be like, I'm bored, you know, and Mom would be like, here's a Andrew Jackson, like a kid's Andrew Jackson biography, like enjoy, you know?
Yeah.
I remember having like very conflicted views about the Civil War as a kid, because I read like, we had this box set of, you know, relatively short biographies on all the Civil War generals. And the Southern generals were just so much better tactically and everything else than the Northern generals. But then at the same time, it's like, well, the Northern generals are fighting against slavery and all of that. I'm like, yeah, but they seem incompetent, you know? And so this sort of like, what is right and social justice and all of this versus like, well, who are the better military tacticians? And so that was the kind of thing that we read all kinds of.
That's really interesting. Going back to your story, you then get married at 18 years old.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Yeah. So my wife and I, her name's Hillary. We met when we were in high school. I was very, like, very shy and introverted. And so the thing that brought me out of that, probably one of the most important experiences, was joining like a theater group that was loosely affiliated. It had a bunch of kids from like church youth group in it, but it wasn't like tied to the church we went to other than that. And so doing like theater production starting when I was 13, maybe up to like 17 or 18, you know, memorizing lines, meeting people, being on stage, all of that was really good for me to get the other side of it. Like not just the book learning, but, you know, how to speak, present, come out of my shell, all of that. And so I think Hillary and I must've been 14 when we were both in the same theater production and met together and just gradually got to know each other and then dated, through high school, and college. We overlapped at college just a little bit. We're the same age. She's 3 months older than I am, but, I rushed through school and everything. But yeah, it was interesting. I'm trying to think on getting married that young. We just knew exactly what we wanted and we didn't wait around for like, we didn't see a point to dating for a long time when we were already certain And then in like 2 weeks, we're going to celebrate our 12th wedding anniversary. And so, turns out we made the right call. Again, I don't like, sometimes people ask me like, do you think everyone should grow up that fast? And it's like, no, I don't think so. There's no reason to rush through life in that way. That was just very much who I was hardwired to be. There are some really fun side effects. Like, you know, we're both, 30 and like have a lot of like, we now can do all the travel that we want. We're going to like our old, we're going to be 40 when our oldest graduates high school, you know, like
it's crazy.
And so just being like, being young and having lots of energy to be there with our kids, I think is really fun. But then there were like kind of the other side of it would be building a career. There's sort of a lot of time where you don't have money, right? You're trying to establish your career in those first jobs. And then that first job, probably at least for both Hillary and I, our first jobs like did not have good vacation time. And so probably the only thing that I would wish for maybe differently is having that time where we both have some money to be able to travel. And then also like before having kids. Whereas we rushed through that. And so now that our kids are a little bit older and we have money and freedom to travel, then it's like we're getting, instead of getting that in like when we were 20, we're going to get it more when we're 30, you know? So
unless a pandemic comes in and strikes out those plans.
Yes, exactly. There's always next year.
I'd love to talk about one of your first jobs or your first job where you left a good salary and solid benefits and a team you enjoyed after a few short weeks after your son was born. And you said you did it because you were comfortable and complacent. How did you make that decision?
Yeah, there was a lot going on then. So that was 2011. Our first son, Oliver, was about to be born. A lot had gone on at the company. They'd raised a ton of venture capital, scaled up a team. You know, I joined as employee 14. At the peak, they were 75 people, something like that. I think we had raised $20 million in venture capital, like a whole bunch of stuff. And then we'd started to go down the other side, like lost a big client, had to do some layoffs. You know, the company spent money very aggressively. And so, there was just a lot going on. And so we'd gone through a few rounds of layoffs and I still had my job. I was working as a designer. I still had my job. I didn't have a team anymore. You know, it was back down to like 45 people or something. And I just remember thinking about like, one, I'm ready to do my own thing again and go back to freelancing, like, you know, or starting my own business. The other thing is, working in a company, I think, often leads to complacency. Like something that I would always pride myself on from that goes back to my very first job, which was working at Wendy's. And we worked the drive-through at Wendy's. And the manager of the store that I was at would call up another store. I still remember it was the Eagle Road store, like across town, because they also had, they were super busy, just like we were. And he would say, like, I can't remember what it was exactly, but he's like, what drive-through time are you going to get today? So the average time it takes from when a car reaches the speaker to when they leave with their food. And then, you know, this big timer over the window that says how long that is. And they would say something, oh, we're going to be 51 seconds. And he's like, ha, okay, we're going to get 49 seconds. Like whatever time you get, we're going to beat it today. And we just dialed in every part of that process. Who worked each job? I worked the cash register. Someone else was on the headset. Someone else was making sandwiches, grabbing fries and all of that. And we just had it completely dialed in. And it was really fun to try to just optimize everything in the system and work absolutely as fast as possible. And I loved it, freelancing, for similar reasons, because you could charge per project. So I would be like, I'll build out this whole WordPress website for you. It'll be $1,000. And if it took me 25 hours, that was one hourly rate. If it took me 10 hours, that was a pretty sweet hourly rate, you know? And so I loved getting paid in that way. But the thing is, being inside a larger company, especially where people stop caring as much and that kind of thing, there was just nothing about speed. And then the average speed of everything started to slow down. And people would stand around the pool table, like complaining about how they didn't get paid enough. And I was like, you're not even working, you know? And I was just another team member. And so there was a moment there towards the end where I just really, really struggled because I felt like I was working at a small fraction of my potential. But if I put in the full effort, one, I'd get burned out in that culture. And then two, it was like, why? Nobody else is, you know? And so I started to feel myself lose that edge and that desire to work quickly. And actually when I left and went out on my own, it took me a while to being able to focus and work quickly and get things done is a skill that will atrophy if you don't work it. And so just noticing that before I left, I decided I'm going to rebuild this skill. And so partially because of layoffs, more space in the office opened up. So I was able to get my own office and position it so that, you know, I was facing the door instead of the door to my, being able to see my screen from the door. And so what I would do is work on my stuff, focused everything for work in 2 hours a day. And then I'd go to whatever other meetings I needed to go to. And then the other 3-4 hours a day that wasn't work, meetings, breaks, all of that, I would spend learning how to code iOS apps and the stuff that I wanted to do. And I was like, look, I can keep up. Everyone is putting in half effort right now. And so I'm going to put in full effort for a very limited amount of time. And then I'm going to spend the rest of the time working on what I want. And so that's how I started to get out of that feeling of complacency. And then also, build up the skills to build iOS apps and, pick up some more freelance clients. And then I had built my own apps and got them in the store. And those were making $2,000 a month, which provided a nice baseline when it was time to quit.
Yeah. And one of those apps was Commit, was so fascinating to me because when I first started my website in March of 2020, I said, I'm going to write 1,000 words a day, every day. And I'm going to have a streaks section of the website where I see my own streak and I'll do whatever streak anyone else wants as well. And I did this for 100 or 200 days, something like that. And you did the exact same thing 9 years ago or 8 years ago. And I was just like, what is going on here? So I was fascinated by that. And your pact to write every day. Where did that stem from?
Yeah, well, I decided that I wanted to write a book. And, the process was like, okay, what's the idea? Here's the outline. I was all excited. And then I would get a few days in, I would start to lose momentum, and then that project would die off. And it's just the same thing. It's motivation-driven productivity, which, by the way, is a terrible way to make sustained progress over a long period of time. It's a great way to work on something that you're excited on and let's put in 20 hours over the weekend and look how much progress we made. So good. But you got to follow it up with a system and a habit. And so I had all these false starts. I'm going to work on a book. Here's the idea. I'm not that interested. Wait 3 months, repeat, same thing. And you basically get to an outline and half of a first chapter, or 1.5 chapters every time. And that's it. And so then I came across some more writing from Chris Guillebeau, and he had a quote where he said, it's easy to write, 100 blog posts a year, 50 guest posts. What else was in here? Several long form magazine pieces, a traditionally published book, and a few, self-published writing projects like guides and all that. Easy to do in a year. And I'm like, what is going on? Nothing about that is easy. He's like, it's easy if you just write 1,000 words a day. You end up, writing, say you write 300,000 words, and then more of that time, the other 50 days are spent editing, refining, all of that. you could write a crazy amount on 1,000 words a day. Tim Ferriss also referred to it as like two crappy pages, you know, just write, focus on getting the work done consistently. Don't worry about the quality, and build that habit. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm not going to have another like momentum and let it fizzle out, kind of thing. And so I started, actually the first thing that I did in true developer fashion is I'm going to do this, but first I'm going to build an iPhone app to help me track the progress. And so that's how the Commit app came to be. And that was fun. I released it in the App Store and it did well, like got featured on Lifehacker and, stuff like that. But then I would build up little streaks. So I'd get to 10 days in a row and then miss a day, and then maybe 15 days in a row and then miss a day and break the streak. But then I was working on a book called The App Design Handbook. And this is one where it's like, okay, this is really happening. And I ended up building a streak up to, I think, 80 days in a row of writing 1,000 words a day. And in that time I wrote the book. I wrote a lot of guest posts for other sites. I, you know, wrote posts for my own blog. I started a newsletter, you know, like kind of all of that stuff. And the fun thing about it is, one, it 100% works. Like that show up consistently every day, absolutely works. 1,000 words is a lot. Like that is hard to do. You got to like set aside at least an hour a day, you know, probably more. Like you can't just sit down and bust it out. But like the conclusion of that is when I self-published my book, I was at about 80 days in a row. The book was out. It did really well. We can dive into that. And the very next day, Commit popped up on my phone and said, are you going to write 1,000 words today? And I was like, nope, done. We did it. Like the book is published. That was a ton of work, but it's done. It feels super rewarding. And then I looked at that streak and it was like 80 days. I just thought, oh, I can't break the streak. Okay. And so that day, I think I wrote a blog post about the launch, like lessons learned or sharing the numbers from it. And then, you know, the next day, like 81 days in a row, what are you going to write about? And I was like, I can't write it. You know, I don't know. I guess I'll write another book. And so the first book was designing iOS applications. And then the next book was on designing web applications. And I just sat down and immediately wrote another book. And 90 days later, I published that. Because turns out in 90 days, you can write 90,000 words. A book is 40,000 words. So you can edit the whole thing. You can write all these guest posts. And it's just like, oh, great. And so I did that. And I ended up keeping that streak going for 600 days in a row. And in that time, I wrote 3 books, grew a blog audience to 20,000 subscribers, wrote tons of guest posts and all kinds of things, and like launched my entire internet career off of that one habit. So if you were to pick a habit, I think you picked a good one in the write 1,000 words a day.
It's absolutely incredible. What made you stop the 600 days? What was the end?
Yeah, it was not intentional. I think it was one of those things that I thought would just continue forever. And there were, like, just to be clear, there were times that I would be flexible with it. Like sometimes I would deliberately take time off, like take a day off to rest or something, and still count it as a day. Trying to think if there's some big life events or something that happened. But I remember times of like, okay, this is a day that we're very intentionally not going to do that. What would happen is I would also let myself get, like I would get ahead. And so I would say like, I don't want to write, I'm going to go camping. I'm not going to bring my computer. And so I'm going to write 300 words extra a day for like, you know, X amount of time beforehand. And then like have one kind of catch up day afterwards as well. So long as it averaged 1,000 words a day, I was happy. So I wasn't strict. The thing that broke it, in 2014, our second son was born. What all happened? Life was super, super busy there. We bought a house, we were remodeling it. You know, had a baby, everything was going well. I was keeping this habit going until like both kids got sick and then no one was sleeping and all of this. And I ended up getting shingles, from all of the stress and
too much writing.
Yeah. It was just everything combined. And so that was actually a long time, took a lot to recover from. I think it was probably 6 months, before I wrote anything substantial again. Because that was like getting shingles, which as a 24-year-old, getting shingles is kind of weird. People are like, isn't, I mean, now it's more understood that it's caused by stress and all of that. But, you know, then people were like, isn't that an old people's thing? Like, aren't you too young for that? But, you know, like you end up taking all these antivirals to beat the infection, and then you take all these painkillers to deal with it. And so it took me probably 6 months or more before I was like back to full productivity.
Wow.
So there's definitely, you got to do things in moderation.
Well, I'd love to talk about One Voice.
Yeah.
And the $13,000 lesson, you could say, from that process. When I was doing research, I thought that was such an interesting story. So if you could share it here, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah. So One Voice was my very first iOS application that I made, or first one I did it on my own. In the very beginning of 2010, Steve Jobs announced the iPad. It was just one of those things. Obviously the iPhone was already out, you know, iOS existed. It had apps. So like a lot of people don't remember that when the iPhone came out in 2007, it didn't have apps for the first couple of years. And actually at first Apple was like, you're only going to be able to do web-based apps where you can basically like save a website for a quick launch thing. But in 2000, maybe a year later, year and a half later, they released an app store and some other stuff. So when the iPad came out, the company I was working for decided, okay, we're going to have an iPad app in the store the day the iPad is released. So it was basically announced in January. I think in April was when, you know, devices would first be in people's hands. And so we had this whole thing of like, how do we learn how to make apps as quickly as possible? So we dove into that. I was doing the design side. It was fascinating doing it for a device that you didn't have, you know? And so I remember like being like, okay, whatever it was, roughly 10 inches diagonally for the screen size. I remember like making, like in the office, cutting that out of cardboard to like get a feel for how big is this actually? And how are these interactions going to work? So it was really fun. We hired a design agency or a development agency in Portland called Small Society. They had built, they'd gotten into iOS like 2 years before, and they'd built like the Obama 08 website and app. They'd done stuff for Starbucks and Whole Foods, and it was just like this brand new thing, and they were some of the best at it. So we hired them to advise us, which is kind of funny. There's a woman named James Keller who worked there. She was one of the owners of that agency. And like I met her a little bit then, but you know, I wasn't that involved and she wasn't on our project specifically. Fast forward to last year, we were hiring a VP of product. And I interviewed this person who, she's amazing. She's like the head of all like UX design for Mozilla and like the Firefox project. And like something just seems super familiar. And I realized like it's the same, like the same James Keller. And she had sold her agency to Walmart. Like they'd been acquired by Walmart Labs and she'd been at Wieden Kennedy and done all of this stuff. And then now full circle, like 11 years after we first met, she now runs product at ConvertKit.
Wow.
Which is kind of wild. Okay. So the apps, my sister-in-law worked with kids with special needs. And so particularly kids with autism who like had nonverbal autism, some of them would have this device, which is like a ruggedized PC. So it's like, you know, inches thick, big, has this massive power cord, all of the stuff. And it would have software on it that would, have words and phrases on it. And then you tap a tile and it had synthesized speech. So it'd speak for you. These kids who had the mental processing ability and all of that, but really struggled to speak, would communicate really well through one of these devices. They had a lot of problems. One, they cost $7,000. The reason they cost $7,000 is maybe because the hardware was expensive. Mostly it's because Medicare and Medicaid would reimburse at that exact dollar amount. And so it's sort of like, that's why they cost so much. They also had a 30-minute battery life, super clunky, all of this stuff. And so she had told me about this and said, you should make an iPad app for it. And I didn't know coding well enough to do that. But I went with a coworker to an iPhone iOS hack, like a hackathon basically, that was hosted at the PayPal offices in San Jose. And basically you show up, you join, people pitch ideas, you join teams, and you spend the whole weekend building and go from there. And so I went there with a coworker. I was doing like design side. He had learned iOS development in the last, you know, I guess the previous 6 months or something, as we all just learned on the fly. And we were just there to learn and get immersed in the community. And just no one's projects resonated with us. And so I was kind of like, well, I don't want to join anyone else's teams. Like, do you and I just want to hack away on this for the weekend and see what we build? And we ended up building a very rough version of what became One Voice, which was that synthesized speech tool, you know, the tiles and building the words and phrases for the iPad. And so that was something where an iPad cost $500. We charged $200 for this app, which on one hand is absolutely crazy. It's the most ridiculous price for an app you've ever heard. At the same time, that made it $700, which made it 10% of the price of the competition, most of which you spent on an iPad, which could do all kinds of stuff. And it, you know, had hours of battery life. It was, you know, a quarter of an inch or half an inch thick or whatever, and just like a better product in every single way at a tenth of the price. And I knew I wouldn't sell very many. And so that's why I chose the $200 price point of like, okay, I'm not going to sell too many of these, but that can make it a real thing. And so I actually spent like for a couple of years, that was one of my side projects of learning how to market and sell and position and just keep adding features and building it out. It was super fun. Actually, I hadn't thought of it in a long time. So I'm glad you brought it up.
And then you sold it and you had a lot of issues with selling it, right?
Yeah. Now I'm trying to remember the details. When I sold it, well, because at the point that I had sold it, like I'd started a lot of different projects. I had three or four iOS apps. I'd written three books. I'd started ConvertKit, but none of these had that much traction. They're all driving, you know, $0 to $3,000 a month in revenue each, you know? And what happens is when you pursue like just side hustles everywhere, it gets kind of, I mean, it just, it dilutes your energies. It spreads you thin. And what I realized is some of these projects, if I put energy into one project, it benefits the other projects. Like if you think of a Venn diagram of, and I actually have a blog post from years ago where I like lay this out. And some of them feed into each other. Like if I talk about a book I wrote called Authority, I'm like helping people write and self-publish books, that overlaps with the commit app because people need to build a writing habit, you know? And also overlap, like effort put into a book like designing web applications. People are like, oh, that's interesting. It's sort of in the similar space. So there's a bit of overlap with Authority and there's those sorts of things. Then I had other projects that were like a flashcards app. Every developer has to build a flashcards app. That were just like totally unrelated. And so I realized I want to only have projects where putting effort into one of them benefits the other projects. And so that meant that the flashcards app had to be shut down. One Voice either needed to be shut down or sold off. I ended up selling, I'm trying to remember, I think I had listed it on Flippa and then it didn't sell on Flippa, but someone bought it separately afterwards. The weird thing is they bought it, you read the blog post more recently than I did, I think for $13,000 and then didn't actually ever take ownership of it.
Correct.
Which was super weird of like, why would you buy this thing? And they were a project manager at Google and looking for a side hustle. And so he bought this thing and then left it in my, like I have all these emails that I sent of like, hey, here's how to transfer it out of my iTunes account into yours and all this stuff. And then there's nothing. And then he came back like months later and then it was like, okay, I'm finally ready to transfer. I was like, great. And he's like, also, I want all the revenue that it made between then and now. And I was like, no, dude, like I have all these emails of like, hey, transfer it out because it was still making sales. And I'm like, no. I can't remember how it shaped out. Like, I think he threatened to take me to small claims court, and I was just like, just take the app. Like, so it ended kind of messy, but there were good lessons in there.
It's crazy because from reading the blog post about your 2013 year in review, it clearly was something that was on your mind. You were thinking about so much. I don't know if it kept you up at night, but it was obviously a real major annoyance. And today you struggle to remember the details.
Yeah.
And the point I'm making is not about you having a failing memory, but it's just about like, just the big issues at certain points in our life are so insignificant at other points. Mm-hmm. Is that also been true from your experience?
Yeah, I think so. There's a lot of things that you stress out about that keep you up at night. It's just the biggest problem. And so many of them, it's just like, it's not going to matter. You know, whether in a corporate environment of like, oh, I got to prep for the board meeting or stuff like that. And then like you get past it, it's in the rearview mirror. Or like, will we win this customer or any of these other things? They obviously add up to a lot of momentum. But yeah, in the grand scheme of things, each individual thing is not that big of a deal, though it feels like it at the time. And if you told someone like, oh, it's not that big of a deal, they'd be like, screw you. You know? You know?
Yeah.
It is a big deal. It feels like a big deal. So it is helpful advice to reflect on over time. It's not useful in the moment when you feel super stressed.
Definitely. So another thing I want to bring up is unsolicited advice. Yeah. And you were on a camping trip with Barrett Brooks, James Clear, Caleb Wojcik, hopefully I'm pronouncing that right, Wojcik, and Matthew Marshall. Yeah. So this was such an interesting concept. And I was like, I got to hear Nathan talk a little bit about this.
Yeah. So we realized we'd formed kind of an informal mastermind group. We'd all met at a conference called the World Domination Summit, put on by Chris Guillebeau in Portland every year. And we'd formed a little bit of a mastermind group and we did this first retreat, and it was actually at Barrett's parents. He used to live in Atlanta and they had a mountain cabin up a ways away. And so we all went there. And one thing that we realized is that we were good at asking for advice. And so we'd be like, hey, I'm struggling to know what to do with this book that I'm writing, this iPhone app or whatever thing. And then everyone would be like, great, let me give you feedback on and answer the question. Like, let me give you advice on this one thing. And then the person would ask for advice, you'd give it, and then they would listen and receive it and all that. And they're like, but are they going to ask for advice on this other thing? Because it's sort of socially like uncomfortable to be like, you know, hey, Danny, I know you didn't ask for advice, but let me give you advice on all of these things, right? And you'd be like, thanks, bro, but I didn't ask for it. Like, you know, you're just not interested in that. And it's just considered rude. So we said, okay, what if we created an environment where we gave people advice that they didn't ask for on any subject is fair game. And so let's say, you know, in the circle, like, what are the things that you say about someone where you're like, oh man, like, they're so good at what they do. Danny's podcast is excellent, but man, if he were to do this one thing differently on the marketing side, it would take off, you know, any of those kinds of things. And it's like, wait, you think these things, you and your friends can talk about them, but you won't tell it to the person. Like, yeah, well, I mean, they didn't ask for advice, you know? And so we just decided that's what we would do. And so the format that we chose is we would set a timer. I think the first one we did was 15 minutes. And so you would have like six or seven of us sitting around in a circle. Let's say I'm on the hot seat. I'd set a timer for 15 minutes. I would get out my laptop, be ready to take notes. And then everyone would start talking about me as if I'm not there. And so it's like, okay, Nathan's gone. We'd make jokes about it. Of like, oh, well, you know, Nathan's not here anymore. Like, what should we say about him? And so it helps to talk about someone in the third person, I think, in that way. Of like, you know, like taking James Clear, for example, because this is before his, you know, Atomic Habits had sold 4 million copies, you know, and all of this. And so we would say things like, James has great ideas for this book, but you need, you know, whatever the next steps needed to be to put it together, any of that. And it was really helpful to say, James should do this, or I wish James understood this thing, rather than you know, like doing first or second person. And so what you would find is you end up hearing the best compliments you've ever heard. Cause it's the stuff that all your friends who really admire and trust and respect you are saying about you behind your back. You just never actually hear it. You know, so it's sort of like, okay, if, I don't know, if James Clear were to die, what would we say at his funeral? Like, let's say that so he can actually hear it now. And then it's followed by the best, like, constructive, said from a place of love, criticism of like, I don't know, someone's been working on this project forever and like either make it into a thing and put in effort or like shut it down and move on, you know, like that kind of advice. And so it ended up being really powerful. And we set that timer. Once the timer goes off, people finish up anything else that they have to say. And then from there, what happens is the person comes back and we're like, oh, Nathan, welcome back, you know? And then you get to go kind of just backwards and work through your notes and say like, oh, Barrett, when you said that made me think of, you know, and like, that's interesting feedback and kind of reflect it back. And we just move around the room doing that. And so that's been such a powerful thing. It's a really good point of connection. It's been amazing for our mastermind group and we've implemented it at ConvertKit and we've used it for the last 5 years at ConvertKit now at all our team retreats. And we have each team do it individually. We have cross teams do it. So sometimes we've had like the whole company giving unsolicited feedback to the engineering team, the whole company giving unsolicited feedback to Barrett and I as executives, you know, all of that.
How did your ego feel when you first heard that criticism?
I think pretty good. You know, it's one of those things that you kind of know what people think already. You kind of know your shortcomings and all of that. And it's just better to have people say it. Like, especially if you're self-critical or you have an inner voice that's pretty critical, then you might be making up things that you think other people think. And that is so much more of an intellectually and emotionally draining process than like just asking someone, what do you think? And trusting that they're going to give like an honest, straightforward answer. And so even if they say something that's really challenging to hear, you know, like, hey, when you do this work, it's not up to the quality that I know you're capable of. It's said in a way where like someone's not saying like, this is terrible quality, you should be ashamed of it. They're saying like, look, I know you can do better. And there's sort of a compliment in there as well as there's like criticism, a compliment and a call to action all in one where it's saying like, I care about you. I want the best from you. I see what you're capable of and you're not living up to it. And so, yeah, it usually doesn't hurt too much, but you have to go in with that expectation that like, it's not about ego.
Makes sense. One of the things that we definitely should talk about is ConvertKit, since that has taken up the majority of your last 8 years, but we spent most of this podcast not talking about ConvertKit. You know, one of the questions that I have for you is, was it difficult to be making a lot of money and doing really well, but be going to a coffee shop and no one really around you aware of the impact you were creating?
Yeah, it was an interesting tension. I remember talking to a reporter about that, maybe the first news story that really happened on ConvertKit in like local paper, the Idaho Statesman, which from you nodding is probably what you read, which is interesting. I actually only recently reread that article. It's a fascinating thing. I think the thing that I struggled with the most is a fun thing about blogging and writing is that it gets attention. And I wanted to feel a sense of belonging. Like when I went to a conference, I was the person who was very introverted, would not introduce myself to anyone, all of that. And so once I started writing and blogging, people would introduce themselves to me and want to talk to me like, oh, you're Nathan, you wrote, you know, whatever thing. And like, I remember this moment at a conference where someone came up to me and said, like, there's a whole circle of people and we're all talking. And I was sort of at the center of it, I guess, like the more, you know, people were more listening to me. It was a conversation, but like around me in that way. And someone like kind of butted in and said like, hey, if my friends knew that I showed up to like, I was at the same conference as Nathan Berry and I didn't say hi, they wouldn't let me live it down.
Wow.
And I had a couple thoughts. Like one, I was the person, you know, like a year earlier who wouldn't talk to anyone at a conference. Cause I was too shy to introduce myself. So this is awesome. Like it's, I don't have to do any work. Two, this is all because of writing. So I guess, thanks mom. Like, you know, writing is such a superpower for that because I can put out these blog posts on the internet and then people want to meet me. Like that is, that's completely crazy. But then there was this other side of it, of building ConvertKit and the software company didn't, it was way more successful, but it didn't have the same profile at all because it, wow. Like you're behind the scenes. So I remember ConvertKit making, you know, millions of dollars a year in revenue compared to the writing business making like $200,000, $300,000 a year, which was amazing. But the, it was like writing business was earning this, ConvertKit was earning this, but the profiles were switched. And it took me a while to just kind of reconcile that of what to do with it. And then especially operating out of Boise. Like there were companies here in Boise, there's a, you know, a decent tech scene here. They were really good at Boise Press and all of that. They opened an office. They were the best place to work. And, you know, in ConvertKit being a remote company and us never really pushing for the press side of it, there were definitely moments where it was like, wait, we have more revenue than them. We're doing more interesting things. Why aren't people writing about us? And the fact of the matter is, if you decide that attention is important to you, then you have to pursue it because that, you know, complaining that people aren't writing about you or you're not getting the press or the stories is sort of like complaining that people aren't buying your product, but you're not willing to do sales, right? Like you have to realize that press is a direct result of effort put into publicity and talking to reporters and pitching a story and creating a narrative. And so, you know, that was a good thing to let go of and realize, okay, I care a lot more about the business results and the impact than I do about the cover story.
How important is attention today for you?
I mean, I definitely appreciate it. It's important. I guess I like both sides of it. I like that I've built ConvertKit as a business that, I remember a time, this is back in 2017, 2018, maybe. I was in Denver for some reason and I like found ConvertKit customers in Denver, sent out emails because I was just like, let me just meet up with ConvertKit customers for coffee. People were like, who are you? Like they, ConvertKit had gotten big enough and my profile, you know, had, it had switched where ConvertKit was the brand and all of that. And so people didn't even know that like I had founded the company. And there's elements of that that's really nice because you can build something that's so much bigger than you. But I do try to keep these things in balance of like, I don't want to fade totally into the background. And so I do enjoy producing content. That's why I restarted my podcast and started doing interviews again and all of that. So it's a balance. I probably think of it also with how can it serve the business? So there are some things that to make a better story, you need a public founder. Let's maybe take a different angle. Let's say you want to talk about a software company on the Today Show, Good Morning America, something like that, right? That is a very hard thing to do. Like why would they ever talk about ConvertKit? But they talk about new books all the time. So James Clear with Atomic Habits to get on CBS or, you know, any of these things, that is a well-known thing. If people are like, oh, author, new book, here's how it's relevant. Great. Let's have them on. So if I were to traditionally publish a book, which is something that I'm working on, that could get a lot of publicity with less effort, you know, in that mainstream channel than, for example, way more effort put into like, here's why you should care about ConvertKit. And they're like, we don't talk about software companies, but with the book, I could say, here's this book. It's called Create Every Day. you know, it comes from my desire as an individual to help people earn a living. That's actually the mission of our company, is we exist to help creators earn a living. And it ties in much more naturally. And so I guess it's all a balance. Sometimes there's pros and sometimes there's benefits to having the company brand be a lot bigger. And then there's other like specific jobs to be done where, as the founder, the individual attention and notoriety is really worth quite a bit. So like all things, it's a balance.
Create Every Day. If that's the name of your new book that hasn't been announced yet, what are some of the most important elements of that book?
Yeah, well, so that is the name of the book. Though who knows, the publisher might change the name. Anything could happen. The book is really about, it's about all the lessons that I learned of going from, I don't want money to be a problem in my life. Like, I want to learn how to make money and how to, you know, that's a skill that you can learn. I want to learn and understand it. And I don't want it to be a stress point in my life, like it was, you know, growing up and, you know, for my family. So it's basically telling the story of that journey and using creative endeavors, like everything I've learned along the way. So there's a lot of things that I talk about a lot of building consistent habits and, you know, showing up for a long time, building the systems to really drive like business success. The other fun thing is I get to pull in, like, we have over 300,000 creators using ConvertKit now, processed over $1 billion in revenue across the platform and all kinds of stuff. And so now I get to weave my own story through the stories of all these creators that, that we follow. So the biggest thing is I want it to just be a roadmap that when someone's like, hey, you know, or like when a year ago, right? If you're thinking about starting this podcast, you're starting writing, something like that, this would be the book that someone would give you and say like, oh, hopefully this will inspire you and guide you along the way.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait to check that out. But before I let you go, I have one final question, which comes from Tim Ferriss, who says, what change in your life or behavioral modification are you most proud of? And just to be clear, Tim Ferriss didn't tell me to ask you that question.
Yeah. Thanks, Tim.
One day.
Yeah, exactly. Let's see. It's a good question. I would say something that people don't talk about enough is like the role of counseling and therapy to create, like, just change your relationship with yourself, with everyone around you, and like with your past. Like, one example would be that growing up, I have two siblings and my dad who are like very big personalities, like you don't want to get on their bad side, like, right? They can get very angry, very loud and all that. And so I grew up with this idea that emotion is scary and should be avoided. And so like one change, probably since I started seriously going to counseling, maybe in actually around the time that I had shingles, like that was sort of like the, got to figure out a lot of things in life, you know, maybe taking a quick step back. That was, I think, something that I did and a lot of entrepreneurs did or do is derive their self-worth from their output, which is a great idea if you can always maintain that your output is super, super high and whatever else. I'm joking. It's not a great idea, but it works. It's sort of this house of cards that you're like, yeah, it keeps working. Cause look, I can write 1,000 words a day forever. You know, like, look how amazing I am. Like, you know, all the self-worth that I have, but you're building on a really fragile foundation. And so if something comes along, like, I don't know, shingles, where you just completely lose your productivity. And then the more frustrated you get, like when you sit down to work and you can't focus, and the more you can't focus and get things done, the more frustrated you get, which makes it even harder to focus. And so it's just this vicious cycle. And then when you let that play into your self-worth, because your self-worth comes from your output and what you create and all of that, then it's really hard to get out of. And so a couple of things, like I think the change that I'm most proud of is one, doing the work to go through counseling and understand a lot of those things. Being able to separate my identity from the things that I create or my output or like my ability to provide value to the people immediately around me. And then like really being able to lean into emotion and conflict and all of those things as healthy and important rather than scary things that should be avoided. I guess it's just those journey, like that whole journey over the last 6 years, 7 years in particular has made a huge impact on my relationships. And then also just the way everyone shows up at ConvertKit, like that, bring your whole self. The number of people that say like, "Hey, I'm signing off for a few hours because it's heading off to counseling. Like, see y'all back later." Like just in Slack at work, like that is a very normal thing. And that's something that I'm really proud of because it's just now part of our culture.
What convinced you, other than the shingles, what made you feel like you needed to go to therapy?
Yeah, that was it. I basically went from a point of feeling, you know, incredibly productive to then just feeling really depressed, you know. And so it was falling into pretty deep depression. And then like a good friend of mine was actually like, "Hey, can I give you some," she didn't say unsolicited feedback, you know, but that was basically it.
And what made you specifically trust that friend as opposed to brushing it off?
That's a good question. She's someone I've known for a long time. She's actually like a year later joined ConvertKit and leads all of our, her name's Ashley. She leads all of our operations for ConvertKit. And, you know, we've known each other for a long, long time. And she's the one that I think she joined ConvertKit was like $30,000 a month in revenue. And she like actually filed the paperwork to form the business and all the stuff that, you know, she turned it into a real business when she came on. But I think probably just seeing that it came from a place of care, and I was also at a pretty low spot where I was like, okay, I need to try something different because this isn't a place that I want to stay.
Yeah. Well, I feel the calmness and presence within you. That's clearly likely a result of doing some therapy work. And I'm really grateful for this conversation, Nathan. Where can we direct people who want to learn more about you?
Yeah. So I have, since, I don't know, 2010, 2011, I've blogged pretty regularly on nathanberry.com. As you alluded to, there are year in review posts every year for the past 8 years, I think. And they're kind of fun to look back on. I would just, if you're thinking about getting into blogging, for anyone listening, a year in review is a great place to start. Not because other people will care, though I am a sucker for reading year in review posts. I love them. But it's just, you'll really appreciate it later. Like it's to have that record. I remember when I first linked to like two or three previous ones and I was like, "Oh, this is great. Like, you know, I've got all these years, you know," and it was like three of them. You know, and now that it's eight or nine or whatever it's turned into, it's just really cool to see. So that's all there at nathanberry.com. ConvertKit, if you're building an audience online, ConvertKit is a tool you want to do that with. We have a free plan, ConvertKit.com. And then probably the last thing I would say is I have a podcast called The Nathan Berry Show. The current focus of it is called Art of Newsletters. And so you can go find that wherever you want. But if you go search for it on YouTube, Instagram, or Twitter, then you can see like there's daily clips that go out. And so it's a good way to kind of dip into the podcast and learn how people are building like the biggest, most profitable newsletters on the web. So that's what I'm up to.
Huge fan of ConvertKit, huge fan of the podcast. Thank you for all you do. And thank you for the conversation, Nathan.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
Enjoyed the conversation with Nathan Berry. If you did, and you have any feedback or thoughts, let me know on Twitter at @HeyDannyMiranda. I really appreciate you listening from the bottom of my heart. It means the world to me, and I will see you in the next one. Peace.